Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Strange Dominions. I am your host, Octavian Graves. Tonight, we speak with Ian Burton. Ian has had a multitude of strange experiences. Some have been informed by his magical practices. If you have seen something weird or strange, such as a cryptid, a UFO, a spirit, a ghost, and anything in between, send me an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. That is, strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. Would like to let you know that we have our Patreon up, so if you would like to support the show and get extra content, you can start by becoming a patron at $4 a month, and you would get extra content, merchandise, and the opportunity to be on the show. With that, let's get into the interview. And tonight, I have with me Ian Burton. How you doing, Ian?
I'm doing well. I appreciate you having me on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure, really.
Of course. So, go ahead.
Well, you know, you and I started, we met and had a very strange synchronicity, you know, a lot of synchronicities going on when we met.
That's putting it lightly.
Yeah,
you know,
really.
I'm still a little bit floored because about that sequence. Like, I guess it was nothing earth-shattering, but it was very consistent.
Well, it was for me because I never really had a lot of synchronicities in my waking life, and so all of that, as quickly as it happened, it was just very eye-opening, and it kind of pointed to a very specific direction that we're kind of going down, and it seems like our paths are intertwining with each other.
I will take that. You know, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I used to kind of enjoy synchronicities a lot. I don't want to say I used to, but I guess at the high points of my practice and, you know, just in life, they were always a cool signpost. That's how I looked at them, like a signpost to that we were involved on some level, that we were doing what we needed to do. Or I was doing what I needed to do. So it was definitely, I felt that. Like when we met and we just had those like boom, boom, boom. Like we met on, I think it was just a Facebook group. You had said you had a podcast and you were just saying, letting everybody know what it was. And, you know, you had advertised it as both the occult and paranormal and high strangeness. And I was like, oh, that sounds like really relevant to kind of the things I'm interested in. I comment. And you're like, yeah. So we sent an IM and then realized we were in the same state because that wasn't a local group. That was like a global, non-local, just a general magic.
Yeah, it was it's a pretty big group. And there's a lot of people on it. Arundel mm-hmm. Overman, who is an author, he pretty much runs it and posts in there pretty regularly about different goetic tools and techniques that he uses and that are prescribed in the grimoires. So, you know, I appreciate that. That group can be a little flaky in his terms as, you know, like genuine practitioners goes. But overall, I enjoy the content that gets posted there.
Yeah, I think it's, is it the Goetia and Grimoires?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Arundel's cool. And I think he kind of does that. You know, he wants that to be, I don't know him that well, but you know, I think he wants that to be a general group, not just for hardcore practitioners, which so you're always going to get, you know, a lot of people who are new or they're kind of spacey or, you know, full of it. You'll get all types and then you'll get the genuine gold material and really serious practitioners too. So I like it. Like, I don't always go there for like the hardcore stuff, but every once in a while you see a really cool post. Like he made a post, I think today or yesterday. It's really interesting. Like
he goes really in depth in the tools and techniques with pictures and like a full overview of how the grimoires talk about them and how he uses them. So I always appreciate that. But
right.
Yeah. So what about you? Let's start with you. How did you get into the occult, the paranormal, the weird side, the night side, if you call it, you know, all this stuff? Where did it all start for you?
Well, I won't say it's, I guess the mentality of it was pretty lifelong. I know a lot of occultists and people who are both spiritual or just in the paranormal, it usually has a certain way they think or are curious growing up. So I was no different. Like, I guess I was the kid. When I was a kid, I wanted to know like what was beyond the edge of the universe. You know what I mean? So I was like reading astronomy books. But I guess when I really got involved with it, I was like a teenager. And I can't say if there was a specific thing. I know that there was an interest that rose in me. And it was kind of like this, just, I was very curious. And, you know, I was into, even at a young age, I was into science. Biology, physics, and I read Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time when I was like 9. And, you know, just I wanted to know how the universe worked. And eventually that kind of carried over into like, well, this is fascinating and beautiful, but I feel like there's more to it. And as I grew into a teenager, I think the first real occult group that I was involved in was like a Wiccan coven, as a lot of us do. And it was cool for what it was. It wasn't, you know, any kind of high magic. It was a Wiccan book. Though I did meet a few people who, looking back, were very, I don't say powerful, but they didn't know their stuff. Like and that was in Maryland. I think it was called Whispering Woods. I was like 16 and I wasn't super social. So it was a cool intro to the idea that other people practiced magic. And I think before that, for me, it was mythology. Like straight up stories and mythology. Like I loved mythology. I used to have this, do you remember the Dorsling's Kinders? I think it's the DK books, like the young adult books that they sell.
I think so.
There was this book and I remember, I think I yanked it from like my elementary school library and it was like this DK book on mythology and the art was so cool. And I know like a lot of people, I'm pretty sure a lot of people know what
I'm not looking at it, but I can imagine the icon on the front cover and it's like a book and it's got DK in red letters, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, this is back in like, you know, the 90s. I had it. I was a kid, but I just loved mythology. I used to absorb it and not just like Greek or Egyptian, but like all of it, Roman, Norse, African, and just the idea. There were like these living stories, and I guess I didn't have like an analytical idea of it then. They were just awesome, wonderful stories about heroes and gods and, you know, just the world being a magical place, and that just drew me. And as I got older, I don't think I consciously understood it, but that was drawing me towards the idea that the world is a little more than just a materialist place, even though there was a bunch of fascinating stuff in that idea too. So, you know, even before I joined a coven or because that honestly, while many important things I think peripherally happened to me because of me being in that coven, it was just that connection to the gods, really, like growing up, like being a little boy and just like loving these deities and figures and just, you know, I was kind of a lonely kid. So that was,
aren't we all?
Yeah. And like, it was like, I didn't have a ton of friends when I was a little kid. I eventually became more social, but like, you know, that was kind of a place that, you know, made my heart feel good. So when I did get older and I started to think about things like magic and even before I knew what it was, that was already kind of there. So I'd say my first introduction was kind of recognizing that these beings, these gods and spirits and this mythical element was more than just stories. And those stories themselves had a lot of power and they felt familiar. So, you know, starting to, excuse me, my voice a little scratchy. So, you know, being around even at a young age, like Wiccans and understanding that there are different, and this is still in like the early 2000s. So we didn't really have that occult boom that I guess we have now with social media. So a lot of the dynamic was still like you had Wicca and you had like people who were more Satanists. And then you had like, and you had, of course, like the chaos magicians and ceremonial magicians. But like at that age, I didn't really know what they were. Like I didn't know what that was. So getting involved with that, I didn't really have a ton of confidence, but it was kind of like I was shown that magic was real, at least in a cultural setting, and spirit was there and that it was a part. So that's kind of how my first introduction to it. But I would say I didn't say become a magician, become like initiated, as I would say it, till I was probably about 17. Though looking back, do you mind if I tell a little story?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And try not to ramble too much, but I guess you are interviewing me. So I remember, and this was really cool. And when I always remember that Wiccan coven, it wasn't Wiccan, to be fair. To be fair, it was a like Celtic witchcraft coven, specifically not Wiccan, though it was, you know, it was neo-pagan. But I remember we just did kind of fun group activities, and one of them was we made like fairy houses and fairy chairs, which is kind of silly, but it was fun. Like we just got all together because there were like people had their kids in the coven and stuff. So it was something we could all do. Like we had popsicle sticks and like little flowers. And, you know, it was crafty, but it was the idea that these were for fairies. And there was intent there. And I remember we built these, I made like this fairy throne. And I made it out of popsicle sticks and I decorated it with all this, you know, cute stuff and flowers and beads and things. And I remember being like a teenage boy, I was like, this is kind of silly, but I still put my heart into it. And
step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I remember that night, I took it home, and I hadn't really done any magic at that point. And I put it in my outside my back door. And I put a little bowl of honey and a little bowl of cream, and I made the intent. I went out there and I said, you know, this is for the fairies. This is for you. And even then, I think I probably felt like it was kind of silly because I hadn't really been into that yet. And that night, I had one of the most vivid dreams I've ever had in my entire life. And I've had a lot of vivid dreams, but that still stands out. And it's importance, I would say, in a symbolic, magical way, didn't become clear to me until much later. And, you know, I had this dream. May I tell you?
Of course, go ahead.
So basically,
whatever you want to say, just like say it.
Okay, cool. So, you know, in this dream, I remember just kind of coming to in the dream state, the dream play world. And I was just in front of this massive double door set into this gigantic tree. Think like a world tree, just this immense tree. And I believe I knew I was dreaming. There was that sense that I had. I remember that. Like I knew it was a dream. It was extremely vivid, but not enough where like I was displaced out of it. I was very much in the dream. So I entered these doors and I was in this grand hall. Think of like the hall of a great mansion, with this checkerboard floor and alcoves. And in front of me at the back of this hall, there were two winding staircases set around pillars on to the left and the right. And between them, there was like a door, but it didn't have like a door in it. It was kind of like a veiled arched door leading in the back. And above it was this mezzanine, this like big balcony. Like you'd think of like a manor, but it was, everything was kind of made out of the interior of this tree. And it was immense, like a castle. And I remember such vividness that the checkerboard floor was black and white squares. And they led straight into, you know, this veiled archway. And I was kind of looking around in the stream. And then I see this woman in brilliant white gowns with like beautiful hair. And just like, she was a fairy queen. Like I knew in the dream, I was like, this is like, think of like Titania. I didn't think Titania at the time, but like, she was like this divine woman in white. And that's the best thing. She was like this divine presence. And she was like on this balcony and she was looking down. And then I think she did, in a dream logic, she was just kind of in front of me. And I see this woman in white with this divine radiance about her in this dream. She's on the balcony on this mezzanine. She looks down at me and I'm just, even in the dream and remembering it, I remember that was the feeling. Like this is like this fairy queen or goddess. And she's looking down and then she's kind of in front of me, is how dreams work. And she speaks to me and we talk. And I can't tell you what she said, but it was important. And it was something that even in the dream state, I felt my heart resonate with. Like, you are, you know, welcome to this place. You are here for a reason. Let me show you things. And I remember walking with her and talking with her. Again, I cannot remember the conversation, but we're walking up these stairs. And these stairs are passing these windows on the side of this interior, this tree manor. And outside, I just see this beautiful expanse of, think of like the Irish countryside, of like rolling hills and farmland, some of it tamed, some of it not, but it just kind of went on into this brilliant endlessness. And she's pointing and I'm looking down there and I see that in some of these hills, there are little people. And some of them, you know, had little clothes on, some of them had wings. And I'm like, they're fairies. Like, there's tons of them. And like, even some of them even had little tiny red caps, which I don't even know if I knew what a red cap was then, but I did later. And, you know, that was just, I suppose a lot happened in that dream that I can't recall, but stayed with me. And later, you know, years later, after I had got engaged with more serious magical and occult practice, and, you know, I started doing the grade work and the ritual work of things like the Golden Dawn, and even the OTO or chaos magic, because I went through all that before, or by that time, I was reading about the Golden Dawn's initiation rituals, like their grade rituals. I don't know if you know much about the Golden Dawn's like ritual work, but they were big on initiatory grades in the sense that as you progressed with your knowledge and your wisdom and your magical practice and your understanding, you kind of like level up. You go to another grade and you're usually tested. And an actual ritual would be done with members of the order, where they would dress up in costumes and the costumes were symbolic. And they usually took on god forms, like a hierophant, things like that. And the initiation ritual specifically took place in the temple. And the temple has, the physical Golden Dawn temples, they have a white and black checkerboard floor to represent the duality. And when you are initiated, the neophyte is given usually white robes and they are guided. Things happen given like spark notes, but generally guided into this temple. And it's, you know, filled with incense and ritualized words are said. And usually there's somebody dressed up like the goddess representing Isis. and you have, well, doesn't get into it, but basically Isis symbolically is standing before basically a veiled doorway, and on either side you have a white and a black pillar, which is a Kabbalistic reference to mercy and severity. And you'll see it on some tarot cards, like the High Priestess, specifically that card. You'll have the priestess is guarding this veiled arch. And beyond it is the idea that subjectively, once you pass that, you're a neophyte, but you're on the path. You're initiated. You are on your way to becoming a magician, somebody who is on that. You're no longer just mundane. So you do that ritual and that initiates you. But looking back, that they had this, I've never done a Golden Dawn ritual in a lodge. I've never been a member of a, like the Golden Dawn specifically, but I did do a lot of the work for it just on my own. And it was just really cool and synchronous that this dream I had 5 or 6 years before I'd ever read that material, reading this, and you know, in Israel Regardi's Complete Golden Dawn, I think that almost to a T, it was the same in the dream. You had this beautiful divine goddess figure almost saying, come. Even like the pillars around the stairs, the veiled archway inside that tree, you know, in the checkerboard floor, it was like, oh, wow, that's really meaningful. And just like it, like after that dream, that's when I felt kind of like the universe started to speak to me back. And from that on, it was like a step-by-step, not always conscious, leading to greater magic and understanding and initiation. So I rambled on with that story, but do you have any comments?
Well, the only thing I would say is that the black and white checkerboard floor, mm-hmm. that's very obviously reminiscent of the Golden Dawn, but that also comes from right. the Freemasons. That's a big thing in there. You know, all the lodge systems more or less comes from the Freemasons. They kind of started it all. And that's really cool. I wish I had an initiation from the universe like that. Mine was, you know, when I was, I have a vivid memory of me probably, this is 2009, so I was 14. I was on the computer and I was like, man, because I've been calling myself a pagan since I was like 5 years old. And right. I was like, I want to hang out with other pagans. Like, I want to do, like, you know, Norse magic or whatever. And yeah, I was online, and I was trying to find, like, Asatru or some kind of, like, pagan group. And I remember I found the website, and I could not figure out how their registration worked. I don't know why. It would confuse the hell out of me. And I tried going on there a couple times. But there wasn't really anything around me at the time that I would have had access to, because I didn't really, you know, I didn't drive. I didn't have any friends who were into it. I had friends who were into metal, but not right. really magic. That was a whole nother thing. The only person I knew who had any regard for magic whatsoever was my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been envious of people who started out young and kind of like had the time to mess up. And now that I'm like, you know, I'm 26. And the other thing is, like, I realize that the solitary practitioner is the go-to model for the modern magician, the modern witch. Like, that's just kind of how you do it. The yeah. idea of having, like, a physical master teaching an apprentice or a teacher teaching an apprentice, that's a very old way of doing it. And a lot of people don't really resonate with that anymore. It's all about, you know, I'm going to do it myself. I'm empowered. I'm going to, you know, just figure this out on my own. And I wish I was like that, but I've never been like that. Like, any kind of knowledge that I've wanted to learn, it was because I knew someone who did know it and I wanted them to teach me directly, or I would look into it and I'm like, this is really confusing. I wish I had someone to actually show me in real time how to do these things, because I have this great fear of trying to figure it out myself, doing it wrong, but not knowing I'm doing it wrong, and just spending all this time doing stuff wrong and not getting anything in response, because I'm doing it wrong. And I had this mindset, especially back when I was like 14, 15, like, well, if I do it wrong and nothing happens, then I'm not going to keep doing it. And I'm kind of glad I didn't do it when I was younger, because I probably would have stopped. I may have picked it up later, but I'm sure I would have gotten it wrong. I would have not gotten anything out of it. I would have thought it was bogus and just moved on with my life.
Right. But if that didn't happen the way it did, like, I mean, you are where you are now.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Oh yeah, everything happens for a reason. So I'm very, like, I'm glad that my path has gone the way it has, because it kind of went from 0 to 60 really, really quickly, especially with the start of this podcast. I didn't think that this podcast was going to open up so many doorways and opportunities for me as quickly and as heavily as it has.
I mean, you are doing your work, as maybe the Thelemites might say, or will. And that's not a small thing.
No.
And like, even talking to you and meeting you, like, I can definitely, like, you know, you do magic and just be involved on that current long enough. You can feel it. Like, you can feel it when you're approaching a project or a person or even just an event. Like, you can feel it when it has a kind of resonance. It has a depth to it, and you just kind of makes your soul pay attention, the best way I could say.
Yeah. And, yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. 100%.
And like, you know, you saying that you were very solo and you wish you had a mentor, like, let me be clear. Like, I resonate that, but let me be clear, even though the story I was talking about being in a coven, like, I didn't really, like, that's me. I've always been solo. I resonate with you as a solo practitioner. I said, I didn't really want to give you the wrong idea that, you know, I said I was in this coven, but I was never really in a magical group ever again. And most of the members of this coven were not, they weren't magicians. Like, the high priest knew his stuff. He was a cool guy and he was very wise. And I did learn some techniques, but I'd say more the periphery of me being that as a teenager was more influential because I was doing it and less because I was taught anything. Like, I did, there was one woman who was really cool. Her name was Neroli. I never saw her again after that, but she taught, like, me and a couple others, like, how to feel energy, essentially, for the first time, how to balance chakras. And that stayed with me, whether you put any merit into chakras or not. But there's a certain way you can allow your mind and your energy to kind of take over and move your hand in a way that's almost subconscious, that allows you to kind of work on that level with yourself or anything. But just those little techniques that I didn't even, I guess I did understand their worth, but, you know, those did stay with me. But I wasn't in that coven for more than a year or two. And after that, it was all just like you said with yourself. It was, I didn't really know anybody else at all. I didn't have a lot of friends at that time at all, much less people who were interested in paganism. But that did give me an understanding that they were out there and that that was a part of my identity. Not only as a pagan, but then also as eventually a magician. And it, you're talking about how you knew metalhead friends, and I know that's a part of your, maybe not your practice on a technical level, but a part of your practice on a soul level. Would that be a good way to put it?
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, it doesn't, the thing that I've kind of realized is that the magic that people talk about in metal, it's a very different kind of thing than what I find to be beneficial to myself. And right. I was actually speaking with Luke, who was a previous guest. He'll be on the show again. And I was explaining to him, like, you know, I'm not a Satanist. That's never been something I was interested in, not because of any kind of moral reasons, but because I had this very heavy, not even a disdain for the monotheistic point of view, but more of like an apathetic Like, why should I hate something I don't believe in the first place?
Right. Like, so why would I just... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but say, you know, so Satanism never really resonated with me. And so I was kind of thinking, like, okay, well, I'm into this Solomonic stuff. How could I, like, do that in a metal way that doesn't immediately put me into, like, a Christian metal group? Because Christian metal is not my cup of tea at all.
Trivium?
And so,
no, wait, not Trivium. Is Trivium Christian metal?
Maybe.
Are they metal?
No, they're like metalcore. They're that metalcore, you know, that early 2000s. Let's make metal cool for everybody.
I had a lot of metalhead friends, and they like there was a group of them that were just into that kind of. And I'd never. I tried. I just couldn't do it. I was like, this is too much for me. I can't. Like yeah, I like metal, but I was more like, you know, punk metal and stuff in the 90s, like Jack Off Jill and Type O.
Oh, I love Type O. That's like one of my favorite bands. I mean, I'm really into the gothic, like goth metal, goth doom, like all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. We could definitely share some music on that.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, well, to be fair, what I kind of meant by, you know, being part of your magic and part of your soul is less the magic that metalheads kind of do and more that you loving metal and where your love for that took you just
I mean without metal I probably like I definitely feel that one informed the other at a very young age
right
so.
Like just that was a part of you that was a part of your beginning and you know whether it had any technical merit on your later work is irrelevant to my comment it was more like that is part of your foundation for better or for worse
yeah
the aesthetic the mentality the interest and curiosity provoked in you is like a door and that's
absolutely
resonating.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean,
that's what I say when it's like part of your soul.
Okay. Yeah, the imagery and the lyrical themes were all very, like, tantalizing to me. And so I was trying to find whatever else I could that matched that or was in the same sphere. And it wasn't easy because the imagery and atmosphere of metal is, like, there's other things that kind of share similar imagery, but, like, from a different perspective, from a different angle. But magic and the occult definitely had that. I mean, it was like the occult's pretty metal. Like when you really think about it, it's a very metal phenomena.
You know, you remind me a lot of, and unfortunately I'm not really in contact with this person anymore, but, you know, he was a guy, one of the original people that I practiced with, and he was one of my best friends. I called him my brother. You know, we went back a really long time and had a lot of really interesting occult stuff. And, you know, we had such a bond that it was, you know, we just kind of looked at our whole life is whether on the surface or in the background as, you know, an act of magic that we were going somewhere with it, whether directly or passively. And he was the metalhead. He was my metalhead friend. You would have loved, his name is Andrew. You would have loved him. Like just listening to you talk, you sound a lot like him. And, he had the same opinion. You know, he's one of my closest friends and brothers. And, you know, he's, you know, we're both in a different spot in life. But, you know, it just reminds me of that. Like talking to you about that, it reminds me that it kind of just warms my heart. And, like, he showed me that. Like, I've never been a huge metalhead, but, like, I could see that because he was, like, he was in a metal band. You know, he did, every once in a while, would even do like Corpse Paint. He was huge in a black metal, death metal. And he got a lot of the heart of his practice just that made him feel alive. You know what I mean? That was like his subculture. That was, you know, he loved it. Not to say that he based his occult practice on it, but, you know, it was a part of who he was. And that was, in my opinion, big things that inform who you are also inform who you are as a magician. You can't escape it.
I couldn't agree more, really. Like, there's parts of you that just, it's going to bleed through no matter what you do, as weird as it is, and maybe as not compatible as you may think it is, it's going to get in there somehow.
You are the sum of your parts, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, and otherwise. And I think that, to me, as I'm not going to be the person who tries to define magic by any means, but I think as I understand the core of magic, in my opinion, is very much tied in with your spirit, and it's tied in with your life. It's tied in with the journey of everything you've done for a lesser or greater things. And yeah, some magic is defined more technically and process oriented. But I think that who you are as a magician is the most important thing. And who you are as a magician is based on everything you've done, whether it's necessarily occulty or not. But the things that really inspire you and change you and sometimes hurt you, and like all those huge things that inform who you are as a person, also influence who you are as a magician, what kind of a magician you could be. And I don't know, that's just how I feel about it. So
I see where you're coming from. I can see the validity in all of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of how my experience has taught me. But, I told you about that dream and how I kind of considered it initiatory. But I want to point out that I would say in my view, like my actual initiation into magic, and I like the word, not everybody likes the word initiation, but, you know, it's almost like, you know, a lot of people associate with like shamanism or whatever ism, but when I say initiation, and I think some people might agree with me, it's that turning point, especially if you're a magician or maybe a mystic or whatever, where you get that part of you that understands that magic is real, that you can do it, can hear it. You can hear the gods. You can feel the magic. You can do weird shit. And there's a definite point. And I do agree with the idea that, like, hold on, let me get a little bit of water. Excuse me. But, you know, I do think there's a root connection between many traditions and paths. Not all of them are the same thing. Not all of them will lead to the same places. But I think on a human base foundational level, certain things are consistent. Like people talk about shamanism as, in whatever form, you know, shamanism as a cultural thing can be culturally specific, but I think the mechanics of it are universal to the human experience. And, you know, initiation is a big part of that. And in some shamanistic traditions and cultural traditions, the idea was that a prospective shaman would kind of be on that path, and their initiation would, among many other things, often involve going on a journey alone, like out into the woods or into the wilderness, where they would meet spirits and spirits would meet them, and they would effectively be torn apart and put back together. But a piece of spirit would be like, say, a bone was removed and a spirit bone would be placed back into them. Like, you would be rebuilt. And the idea is that when you were done with that initiation, you were both spirit and person, and you had access to that world now. And I think that does carry over, at least in my experience and in my path, how I've done things, that is warranted. And I think certain traditions will look at it in different ways. Some people may not have that experience. But, you know, for me, I had a moment where that occurred. And that would, in my eyes, I consider that my initiation. And it's just talking to you about being a solo practitioner. Like, I had that dream and that was fine, but that was almost like, to me, I thought later on, I looked back and I said, you know, that really was kind of a send off point before I realized what it meant. But before I go into another story mode, is there anything else you wanted to ask?
No, man, you're all good.
Okay. I just didn't want to carry on too long, but, you know, after I parted ways with that coven, what I was left with was my curiosity had kind of been sated. I knew there was something. I had experienced some interesting, you know, magical effects. I saw a little bit of the paranormal in a general way. Like, I had seen a bright blue pentagram appear in the middle of a circle of people who were all focusing on it. And like, in a very real, like, that looks like neon bright blue light in the middle of this circle with my physical eyes, not the mind's eye, things like that. And I was like, okay, definitely. But I didn't really meet anybody else at all. And I was just a teenager and I was just getting my social footing. And when I was like 17, I met like this really big group of, you know, kids, and whatever, or like Mall Rats and Street Kids and Neighborhood Kids. And, you know, I made some good friends through that, and also a couple friends in my neighborhood that I had met. And none of them were on the surface really like occult oriented. We were all just teenagers. But I remember we were just doing stupid neighborhood 17-year-old stuff. And I think I had my friend Kyle, this kid Andy, you know, a guy named Joe, and like a couple of us. And I don't know where it started. Like, we were just doing stupid, mundane teenage stuff. And I remember walking down to the other block on the other side of the neighborhood to meet up with everybody and hang out. I was like 17. And, you know, they were all doing weird stuff. And it was, I don't remember them ever doing it before this, but like another guy I was close to, his name was Tyrone. The guy Joe and I think Kyle and Andy were, they were sitting there and they were like just chilling, and they were basically, they had their hands together like they were holding an invisible ball and just like fucking with it. And I was like, what are you guys doing? And they looked at me and they were like, we're just messing with energy. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, what? And so they were just doing this really simple energy work, and I didn't really even believe them at the time. And they were like, no, like, you can feel it. Just put your hand between these hands. But that was like me as just a mundane teenager with a bunch of other mundane teenagers who were suddenly doing lightweight, definitely not like grimoire level magic, but just like stupid, silly energy work.
And, can I just ask you a question? Can you like explain energy work just for anyone? Because I don't really know. Whenever you say that, I've been wanting to ask you, like, what does that mean? Like, what is that?
I mean, it's a pretty new agey. It's kind of got like a new agey connotation. People think energy work, like energy healing. Like, I'm not going to knock that. I definitely, there is stuff. But when I say that, I don't really have a better term for it. But I guess you could say just it's like prana, it's chi. Like, somebody will probably yell at me for using those terms. But like, it's just, I'd say what we were doing then was just like your life force energy, like your aura energy, like every living thing. Energy. Everyone, every living thing does. It's whether you want to make it complicated and say there are different kinds, but I believe it's the close thing is probably what people would consider chi. It's just that it's your life energy, and it can be, it's the same thing that would make up your aura. Maybe people who are into more grimoire level magic might call it the body of light. That is something that goes back to the PGM days, like the Greek magical papyri and stuff.
I've been wanting to dig into that one for a while and like trying to dissect it and work it.
And a lot of times when you're talking just to do more advanced magic, like doing God forming or, you know, literally just invoking the presence of a deity, which is present in, you know, newer age magic work and lodge magic and also grimoire magic. Like, you are taking the essence of this deity into you and essentially gaining magical powers. But what that is kind of doing is it is empowering your body of light, like your etheric body, if you want to look at that. Like, it's just that it's the part of your energy field. Like, everybody has it. Is that, maybe I'm being a little vague and I'm not being technical enough, but I could probably be technical and say that there's lots of levels to your being and your soul and your spirit, right down from the physical body to, you know, your divine nature, your core. And they are kind of levels of it, and they all can kind of interact with a different level of reality or spirit. That's how I see it. That's how I taught. But what we were, when I say energy work, it's literally just kind of that prana chi energy. It's almost, I don't know if there's like a scientific idea of it, but whenever you hear somebody just talking about that life energy, that's kind of what it is. It's just your own personal force, and it can physically be felt. It can do things. It's not really, I wouldn't consider it like matter or energy in like a scientific level, but it is, it works. And I guess to say it, anybody can do it. We used to play around with it before we knew its significance, before we knew any kind of magic in a specific sense. But were literally just kind of focus and clear our mind. And that's how it was taught to me. But because that was kind of the part of the story is I didn't know what they were doing. I didn't really know what that energy was either. And they were just kind of like making little invisible energy balls in their hands. And I thought it was silly. And they were like, no, stick your hand and you could feel it. And I did. And I didn't at first. And then I did. And it felt kind of like I was sticking my hand through almost like static electricity, but different, like almost like a very, very light liquid, just a faint bit of resistance that was noticeable. And that's how the first, and I was like, whoa, that is like just that tiny little thing kind of floored me. And it was very sudden. I was like, oh, but then I couldn't do it. And they were like, well, you try, you know, clear your mind, just kind of meditate for a couple seconds and just visualize your hands as they are in front of you. And then just visualize like white light, like energy flowing in it. Just visualize a ball and then feel your hands wrapped around it and apply force as if that ball was physically there. And, you know, at first I couldn't do it, but, and I remember I was, and before I continue that story, but maybe that wasn't a good adequate explanation, but did that help a little?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that a lot of, you know, one thing that I have always struggled with and is the concept of like visualization, meditation. I started meditating last year when I really decided to get into magic, but I still to this day don't know if I ever did it right.
I'm like, terrible at it.
My mind just goes 1,000 miles a minute. I can't, you know, there's no clearing my mind. There's just letting images come and go without any kind of, you know, manual thinking. It's just totally passive.
I'm kind of the same. Like meditation's hard for me. And like, especially back then. And it wasn't like a, you know, a Buddhist sit down in the.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
In the form and.
No, but just like I, you know, I see it in a lot of the more modern magic books, like meditation is like the core of it. Visualization is like a big deal. And if like for me, I always felt kind of like not ostracized, but pushed out because like just visualization doesn't make sense to me. Like I see all these people talking about like, oh my God, I astral projected last night and I met Odin.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, how? Well, if you don't know, you won't be able to do it. I'm like, well, yeah, I know I can't do it because I don't know how. Well, too bad, man. That's just, you know, it's just not in you. Like, oh my God, really?
What's interesting is that I feel like I'm kind of playing the devil's advocate with you in this conversation, but everything you've said for years, even now, is literally my issue. So I am not biting you on it. Like that was something, and honestly, I'll continue the story in a minute. That was that frustration and that ostracization was a huge part of what brought me somewhere else. But yeah, like I've always had trouble with meditation and like I'm better at visualizing now. But back then, my mind, I had no really mental control. You know, I got some ADD. You know, it was very difficult. And again, I used to encounter all these people and even the person who'd become my mentor, who was very patient. And they were just making things sound so easy. And these books I was reading just made it sound so simple. And I was like, this is really hard. I don't think I'm doing this. I'm not doing this right. Cause I'm not asked. I don't know how to astral project. I keep trying, but nothing's happening. And, you know, I don't want to sit here I can't imagine sitting here for like an hour, just like clearing my brain. Can't even do it for like 2 minutes. It's difficult. And, that was a thing, but I guess, talking about like the silly stuff about like making energy balls, I'd say now, I don't even, visualization is helpful. Whether it's essential, I don't think so, because I think that's something that anybody would be able to do, even if they weren't good at that. Like, I firmly believe that, because I've met a lot of people who can do weird stuff, like, your body and your brain and your spirit will work best and do the best it can based on what you are able to do best. So if you're not good at visualization, that's fine. You might be able to do the same thing even better in a different way. That's what was assured to me later, because I used to get so frustrated. And it was like, I remember me and you have talked about one of the big desires was to see spirits as why we were interested in magic, right?
Right, yeah.
Right, and that was a huge thing when I was younger. I wanted to see weird shit. When I was a young person, like, I wanted to see it. I wanted to sense it. I wanted the universe to be weird at me. And I wanted to see what all these other people were apparently seeing, and I couldn't. And it was very frustrating. And you know, one day my mentor years later was like, I was like, I just can't, I'm not seeing things. Like, I had a little, and there were certain instances where I had, definitely. But, you know, and they just told me, they're like, yeah, but they're like, I know you really well. Your visualization is actually fantastic, whether your attention isn't great or not. And, you know, we were talking about divination. They're like, you know, my mentor's like, you know, even if you don't see a spirit physically manifesting in front of you, you know, and they were like, tell me how that works and stuff. And they're like, that doesn't mean you're bad at it. Like, you're getting, you know, I realized after a while, like, I was getting spirit communication almost on a data dump level. I wasn't seeing the spirit in front of me telling me words as much. But after years, I realized, like, I sought, or I'd say I sought the information, or I would try to figure out what a spirit was, or try to convey information the spirit was giving me. And I was ignoring the fact that I would just kind of know, but I was I had a lot of doubt. But when I kind of removed that doubt, I didn't need to have the visualization as much or physically see them. Though, again, I will say in the future that did change. Sometimes you'll hear it. Sometimes you will, even some people get touched. Everybody's different. Their brains work differently. And there's actually a word for it, or one word for it. It's called intellectus. And it's one way of, I think it's from the Middle Ages. I don't know who originally said it, but it was a term to describe how angels think, whether that's valid or not. But angels, in this sense, they don't think. They don't have to. They just know. Anything that they need to know, they just know. And that was how it was viewed. I think it was a Kabbalistic text. And they refer to this ability as intellectus. It's just, they need to know something. They're angels. They just know it. And that is something that, on a certain level, people can, I don't want to say all the time, obviously, but in certain states, people can achieve too. And I think that's a powerful thing. And, like, I didn't have any confidence, but I realized, like, I could get into that state too sometimes. And my mentor reminded me, they're like, you know what? Just because you're not good at astral projection, just because you're not good at visualizing or traditional meditation. And he pointed out, he's like, you know, you don't sit in cross-legged all the time and medicate because it's hard, and that's okay. But you go on walks at night and you just think, don't you? And your thoughts come together. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, that counts. Or, you know, just talking with somebody and just having that where your mind kind of settles down and you just talk with one other person about, say, occult things. And you do get that synchronicity. You do get that information conveyed. Am I making sense?
No, I understand what you mean.
I guess I'm just saying that my whole thing was that just because one person isn't good at one thing, I think we get set in the idea that we read certain books from people who are good at what they're teaching. And we get caught up in the idea that we have to do it that way. But, you know, our souls and whatever parts of us can do magic are way more complicated than a book or a technique. Like, we are adaptable. We are brilliant living beings with spirits. And if there's anything about spirit or personal spirits, is that it's adaptable. We are all unique, and it will find a way to get us to do the things we need to do in our own unique way. And honestly, it sounds cheesy, and people are like, have faith in yourself and trust yourself. It's important. Like, and it's really hard to do. And a lot of times you don't even realize you're not doing it. But that is a huge thing. And I'd say, at least from my experience, that when that can be reached, your practice will benefit. Because I feel like our souls do know, I say souls, like our complete selves, they do know what we seek when we do magic. And if we do have that balance between consciously what we want to do, whether we're doing a ritual from a grimoire, or if we are, doing chaos magic ritual, if we're just trying to do some divination, we have that intent consciously. And the parts of us that can make it happen know that. And we have to have that balance. And once we can trust that to do it, we get better at that communication between, if you want to call it, the unconscious and the conscious, then it gets smoother. And if we let it, it'll help us achieve it in whatever ways you need to us. And I think maybe that's vague, but I'll stick by that. I'll say what I said with it. So again, even if you're not good at visualization or meditating, it doesn't make you less. It just means that's not your way to do it. But you're still a magician. You're still learning. And there's other ways for you to get these results. Like if you call a spirit and the spirit shows up, it'll be there. Whether you see it or not, or you hear it, it will be there and you'll know it will be there. Spirits don't always show up, as you know, physically. A lot of times, even the best magicians I know will describe them. They'll show up and they'll talk through synchronicity. They'll talk through little things that appear. Maybe a little sound, or maybe, a bird will appear, just something.
I really hope the first spirit I have contact with talks to me in a Cockney accent.
Oh, yeah. I hope so, too. Maybe it'll be John Constantine's ghost. But no, that's a thing. And you can talk to even some of the grimoire people, I'm sure. Evoking full body manifestations of gods. And, I think I read something from Jake Stratton Kent. He's a really respected guy.
Jake.
Yeah, Jake's awesome. And he's one of the most, I would consider him top tier in his experience and what he's done and what he can do. And even he says, I was reading, I don't know, it might have been his Eliagap writing, or I don't remember. But even he says, he's like, it's kind of the cream of the crop to get physical manifestation. Like, that is, even the best magicians have to try really hard for that. And it's one, it's up to the spirit. Two, it's up to the circumstances astrologically and environmentally. And also, it depends on you. Sometimes this is not going to happen. And a lot of times, spirits will show up in very non-physical ways. They'll appear in your mind's eye. They will direct your thought process. And it's stuff that I think when people say that meditation is valuable, it's because it can give you a little bit of understanding of your thoughts and how they go and what your thoughts are and what aren't your thoughts. Because a lot of times spirits will just communicate through impression. You'll just start thinking or feeling a certain thing. And normally your brain is just a very fluid, current. Like, you'll just, one thought here and then another thought there. And you won't even think about it. But when you're doing spirit work or communicating with spirits, that is often how they will communicate with you. They don't always use words, because they don't really use words. They're spirit beings. Words are a translation. They communicate through intent specifically. So when you have that intent and you communicate with the spirit, they don't hear your, I can't say they don't hear your words. I'm sure they do, but it's the resonance and the intent you put behind them that they can perceive. And that is how they communicate. That's what was taught to me by a spirit, because I was curious. And I was like, how does this work? Do you like hear the words? Does it matter? How are you talking to me in English? You're not an American. And I got this, spelling out letters. I was using a divination technique. And then in the mind, and I realized that, they see us as, like, they see our intent. They feel our intent. So when we say, I need this, or I want to see you, or that is like, I mean, I can't describe how it looks because they don't have eyes, but per se, maybe they do. But, they get the direct data, and then they give us the direct data, and our brain can translate that into a way, or they can use a little more energy and make it something physical for us, or give us a little synchronicity, or, something even more direct. But I think at their core, spirits just communicate intentionally. Like you feel that, like sometimes you'll feel fear or love or interest, or your brain will just be filled with certain thoughts. You'd be like, oh, whatever. That's an idea. But sometimes those ideas are, spirit's just putting that idea into your head. It's showing you what it's communicating. Without the secondary, unnecessary step of words. Does that make sense? That is my experience with it, as I've been taught in my practice.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. Okay. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about was, you brought up to me a few days ago about this evocation that you and your mentor were planning on doing, and I had asked if I could join. You said, yeah, but I'm curious.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that? Because we didn't really get into specifics, but I've been very curious about that since you brought it up to me.
Okay, fair. I know we had not set that in stone. We were kind of brainstorming it. We both had the intent that it would be cool. And I know me and you talk about a lot of high strangeness stuff too, like the euphonauts and cryptids, which I'm sure we will talk a lot more about in
absolutely
the podcast and stuff. But we were just talking, neither of us have done, me and my mentor were, we were just on IM and chatting, talking about magic, and we were originally talking about UFO stuff, as we'll talk about both, but I don't remember the exact beginning, but it kind of turned into, hey, we haven't done like a good ritual in a while. And I'll be honest, like I don't think there was a really set intent to like summon a spirit to get something, but we were discussing originally, and this is more in the UFO territory, like the euphonaut, the idea that a lot of these entities often seem to begin, like their true state, at least as they manifest, seems to be just balls of light. Have you heard that? So we were kind of just discussing some of the UFO lore, and we were talking about spirits in just our conversation. And we were like, we haven't done, some good hands dirty magic for the hell of it in a while. So if that was kind of the beginning of us talking about doing this ritual, that we had talked about it before. And I think the original conversation is, we were talking about how I was listening to one of Brad Steiger's books the other day. And it was the one I think I recommended to you, like The Real Visitors from Other Dimensions or something, whatever the book's called. And there's the idea that a lot of the UFO phenomena and cryptid phenomena, like they're, I don't want to say their actual form, but it seems to be more or less their true form as they, before they appear as something, seems to be like literally like a glowing orb of light, like a globe of plasma. You ever heard that?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, like almost like will-o'-the-wisps, where people see that they're like living lights, literally, whether they're in the sky as UFOs, but you hear these reports all the time, and oftentimes they are accompanied by people seeing traditional spirits or ghosts or poltergeist phenomena, or
the lights show up in almost everything between Bigfoot phenomena, UFO phenomena, UFO or ghost phenomena. The lights are everywhere. I mean,
and that seems to be a key, and that's something that I was thinking about, and I have been thinking about. I'm like, and we'll save the meat of that thought process for a different time, and we're talking more about that kind of thing. But it kind of goes into some weird science, but essentially, these balls are described as plasma, like fourth state of matter, plasma. Like just really bright, living, intelligently moving orbs of super bright light of various colors. And they are often mistaken or confused with ball lightning. Now, a long time ago, I should say, I was listening to Brad Steiger's book, and that was filled with different people talking about their accounts. And one of them was talking about ball lightning as a natural phenomena where it's little understood, but essentially they're floating balls of lightning that have been seen traveling across the ground. They've even, and one of the things that was mentioned is they've even been described melting through windows, like leaving a hole in windows because it's lightning, it's super hot. And usually they dissipate. And they're not super dangerous, but there has been reports of people injured or even dying by touching them because they're lightning, just in ball form. And I'm not saying that ball lightning is inherently spirit, but it was the thought process that something like that can be what some kinds of spirits or these intelligences may kind of be their natural form. And then after that, they can either create a form or project a form into the minds of people that observe them. Whatever. But I heard that specifically, that, you know, somebody had said they had seen ball lightning literally pass through a window. And my mentor, ages ago, years ago, told me this story when they were a kid. And they were, you know, they were maybe like 6 or 7. And they walked into their kitchen and they saw this bright, glowing, crackling ball that smelled horrible, just floating through their kitchen. And they were like, oh, wow, cool. That's pretty. And their dad came in and kind of grabbed me like, don't touch that. That's ball lightning. And this thing just floated through their kitchen, through the window and out into the yard. And like, that's a story they told me. And then I heard it on this book. So I messaged them and that was like the foundation. And then we were talking about how like these different entities seem to, they're, oh, these living lights are present in so many different varied reports of euphonauts and cryptids, and how that's the heat and light factor, in addition to the sound factor of all these different phenomena and around these balls of light, so to speak, they have environmental effects. And you've read that, like, you know, they're very hot and, you know, whatever. I'm trying to think specifically of what I was trying to get to with that. But the idea is that, hey, we were kind of interested in connecting the dots between things like euphonaut entities and cryptids and more traditional spirits, as you might find in like the grimoires, or even things like ghosts or whatever. And I think the answer to that's, it's not clear. And that's something I'm interested in exploring. So we're like, okay, we had not picked a specific spirit or entity. In my mind, I was thinking about maybe finding a more recent UFO report or cryptid report and maybe just focusing on that being and using some divination to see if we could even approach getting the proper tools to evoke it or summon it. And again, it wasn't, the idea wasn't like a established grimoire tradition with robes and wand, though we do have those things. We'd probably utilize them. It would have to be something we made up on the fly because it's not a named entity. But
what if you did like a full traditional, like by the book, goetic ritual and contacted a mercurial spirit and then asked them to, you know, get laid out the parameters of this spirit that you're trying to contact and then ask the ambassador spirit to bring that spirit to you?
Well, that's where we actually gone with that. And I know we were talking about, I messaged my friend Allison Chikosky, who we both know. She's wonderful, wonderful magician. And, you know, I'd asked that about, I think you had mentioned emissary spirits. And then I was like, hey, what, any advice? Someone just told me to ask her. And she brought up a Mercury, one of the pentacles of Mercury. I think it was the 6th one. And I knew it, but she knows a lot more than about that specific thing than I do.
Speaking of that, I just, I ordered a 4th pentacle of Mercury yesterday, and it'll be here soon. So I'm excited about that.
Allison, you deserve all of this promotion. Now, I have a couple of her.
Well, this was from Frederick Ashton Chasson, but yeah.
Okay. No, I think I don't know his work too well, but I've heard good things that they're all doing good work. And, you know, they're basically from the Solomonic, they're Solomonic pentacles.
Yeah.
From the Keys. And, you know, I have 3 or 4 from Allison. I think 2 Jupiter, 1 Venus, and good heavens, I can't remember the 4th one off the top of my head. But basically it is that, yeah, we needed a Mercury talisman, or didn't need it, but it would be an interesting addition. And she was talking about the Altori, and me and my mentor ended up doing a little, like, he's made talismans himself. He's pretty an old school magician. He's been at it for like 45 years. Very solitary, but not always. So he's made his talismans. He knows Solomonic, and he's very practiced in grimoire tradition as well. So yeah, we had definitely thought about using the more traditional method and using the mercurial spirits as emissaries. Like, that's a good idea. And me, him, and you both agreed that it would. The only issue with doing a more traditional goetic working without having those spirits act as emissaries and fetch it, because I think that's a, I would like to do that. We haven't set down the ritual completely yet. But if you're talking about like the Gaweisha, so if you're talking about the Gaweisha as in like the 72 spirits of Solomon, all those spirits have unique components and metals and incenses and, you know, days of the week and hours that are required almost like a cell phone number. That's how I look at it. Like they have a certain resonance in order to get that specific spirit. They have a specific name and they have a specific sigil. So you always know who you're going to get. That is their calling card. When we're talking about a vague entity, like something somebody encountered in a euphonaut report, like Injured Cold, for instance, you know, is not known as a traditional spirit, but certainly behaves like a kind of spirit. And that's the whole point of us doing it. We want to see if we can summon one of these odd beings and what happens if we do. So we'd have to completely create and come up with a recipe to do that.
Or, and I'll tell you something, that this is exactly what I'm trying to do. You don't have to do anything like that. You can literally go through a full, like, by the book, goetic ritual. Mm-hmm. That means, you know, the prohibitions, the fasting, the abstinence, the washing, the prayer, the confession, all that stuff. Right. You get the planetary hour, you get the planetary day, you get the right candles, you make the circle, the robe, the whole shebang, right? Mm-hmm. You get yourself a mercurial spirit, an ambassador spirit. And you tell them, and this is something that I'm like actively trying to do. That's the only reason why I know I'm like saying it with any kind of authority is you question them about them giving you some way of calling any spirit, any entity that is of an incorporeal nature and to you. And you very specific, you know, your charges have to be super specific here. You have to basically tell it, like, let's say, there's so many of the mercurial spirits you could use, but just any of them would most likely do it. Any spirit in the Gaweisha that has a an office that is around the concept of knowing anything celestial or earthly, stuff like that, ones that where knowledge is a very big part of their office. What I want to do basically is say, okay, I want you to give me a method of calling whatever is close by and the ability for me to, you know, if I have to make them communicate with me or if I have the ability to communicate with me or with them, so that way I can, you know, carry on a conversation with them. Then you can ask it its name. And if you can ask it, you know, what it is, and try and interrogate that spirit that you now have in your general sphere. If it's not going to tell you, there's a spirit in Gaweisha that can tell you everything. All you need is that name.
But absolutely,
that's what I that. You know, see, that's the thing that makes me, that's the thing that interests me so much about the Gaweisha. And I think a lot of people get so hung up on very specific parts of ceremonial magic, whether it be the calling on the names of God or the long periods of preparations or how expensive the tools are or anything like that, but they don't realize how powerful that is, because once you get that down, once you have a couple of genuine Solomonic rituals under your belt and you have a relationship with these spirits, and I'm not talking like frou-frou demonology kind of stuff, I mean a very strict working relationship, then you can ask it. I mean, these things are very, very, as long as it's in their office to be knowledgeable, then they're going to be knowledgeable. And you can start accessing different pantheons, different entities that are not in any kind of grimoire or old book on magic or anything like that. And you can start building your own practice that has never been done before. I mean, that's the entire, that's the thing that this show is really about, is trying to find the occult methods that have already been discovered, to use them to discover new things that nobody has a name or image of.
I would say 100%. And, you know, like, that's what we had kind of decided to do in, like, to work with the Altori and use the sixth pentacle of Mercury to do exactly what you're saying. And I would say I agree with everything you just said. And that's a wonderful idea. And that's actually where we had aim to go to work with the sixth pentacle of Mercury and see about actually working with some specific emissary spirits for that purpose. So I'm right in line with what you're saying. There are other techniques that we've utilized to good effect, but I think the results essentially going to end up being the same. Like I said, my mentor is a little more proficient with Solomonic casting than me. I'm not bad at it. I'm just a little more inexperienced at the traditional methods of it. It's because I've developed my own kind of practice, but it does utilize parts, and these things work regardless. Like, they work because they work. They're techniques, they're technology. And to me, it's always a possibility. It's not like in my mind I'm arguing whether it's real or going to work or not. I know for me, not as, you know, to contradict you, because honestly, that was kind of where we were heading. And the whole ritual itself and the evocation is something we are still talking about. It's been a busy week that I would like to include you on. And so we can decide what exactly we'd like to contact and summon and the exact method on how we do it. And, you know, you're talking about those emissary spirits doing most of that work for you and not having a limit. Like, that's essential. That is a brilliant piece of technology in a relationship with certain spirits that can, like you said, you can go really far above and beyond with that. I know with the absence of using mercurial emissaries, I have personal techniques, because I do have a familiar spirit that I work with for a long time, that essentially kind of serves that role, at least on the information. So what I have done in those circumstances, and probably would if I didn't utilize that, or even if I did, was essentially divine directly the time of day for that specific spirit, if before any name was found, the type of day, the time of day, and excuse me if I'm derping out a little bit, basically divine the data on all points that would fill in and make that ritual the case. And you do that divination, you know, in ritual. You do it after you did your consecration, after you did your purification, if you wanted to do that, whatever, to get your power up. And essentially you get the same result, but the difference would be at that point, how I would do it in that way would probably be using my own personal call. Like, hey, I'm calling you directly. I'm not just sending somebody to get you. But the end result should be very similar. That, so we hadn't even gotten that far yet, but one of those two methods, the idea is that let's summon one of these weird entities and see what happens. And the fact that we've all been thinking about the mercurial spirits, and I didn't, there's not a lot of information. My friend had mentioned the Altori, so what they're called, and they're a kind of, they're among those mercurial emissaries associated specifically with the sixth pentacle of Mercury. There's not a lot of information about them, but they are described as shadow beings. Literally in a grimoire, they're described as shadow beings.
Which grimoire?
Oh, goodness. I'll have to, let me, I will send you the information later. It's one of the medieval ones. I will definitely send you that. But it's just a little segment in it, and it basically says they are shadow beings of I think it was like a tumulus and violent nature, but they're described as essentially chthonic spirits. So they would be terrestrial and chthonic spirits, which is interesting that they are mercurial, sort of, but that's how they're described. So in my estimation, at least some of those emissaries associated with that pentacle would be likely chthonic, maybe even, and they're associated with necromancy. So likely you'd be dealing with, yeah, they're, from what I saw, and again, I didn't do a huge research, but from what I did, they're, the Altori are a, they're described as like shadow beings of a tumulus and violent nature. They're associated with necromancy, and how they're described suggests that they are chthonic. So they are spirits related to the underworld, as opposed to, you know, maybe the high aether or, you know, the elements.
Well, so from what I understand, like, while I think most, if not all, the at least in the Goetia, the spirits are chthonic, they still have knowledge and some experience in, like, outer realms and non-chthonic areas. I think that word, like, it's of the earth, and I think a lot of people assume that that probably means, like, under the earth or in the earth, and I don't know if that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one that has always, like, I accept the term chthonic, but I would also much rather use the term sublunar. I feel like that is a much more accurate description of what their essence is and what their abilities are and what their experience is in the known world.
Well, that's fair. As I understand it, there are differences. I guess chthonic spirits would be still considered sublunar in that way. But as I understand it, my experience and what I've read and kind of worked with is that there is a separation. Some spirits aren't chthonic. They do exist specifically as related to under the earth, and some of them exist in the air or in the seas. And that this type of sublunar, these types of sublunar terrestrial based spirits,
you can say chthonic. It's okay. I don't mind. I was just.
Oh no,
saying,
I am. I'm saying like the idea of a chthonic spirit directly puts them as related to the dead in the underworld or under the earth. Specifically, that others, all of them are sublunar, but they are related to the different areas of the earth, or the water, or the air, or the aether, or beneath the fixed stars. And some of them are specifically chthonic. Like some deities they're vast, so they have different offices and different faces and different forms in many different areas, like Hecate. Is a chthonic goddess, but she also has forms that are not. Like she has forms that are transcendental and very much placed in the earth and not in the underworld. But she is probably best known as a chthonic deity. As, the guardian, she is a figurehead and a powerful force of magic between the living and the dead, like into the euphonauts. And yeah, I'm just saying the euphonauts as a catch-all. You know what I mean? The right. Elementals.
Oh yeah,
because that is they intersect. And but back to kind of the focus here, I'm not necessarily the expert on goetic spirits. Like I have enough. Like I know what they are. I know what they can do. I've worked with some of them, but there are definitely people who've written books. I haven't. But in my experience, that yes, you do have spirits that are absolutely chthonic. That is their nature. Just like you have spirits that aren't, and you have deities and great spirits who may have offices in different realms. But I'd say probably the lesser spirits or the more, not the big ones, not deity level. If we're talking about this kind of species, because I do believe, and in my experience, spirits aren't just sublunar. There are transcendental spirits and spirits that don't even fall into those categories. But yeah,
You're familiar with BJ Swain, right?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, have you read his book, Living Spirits?
I have not actually.
There's a term in that book that I really, really enjoy, and I'm going to start using it like all the time. He says, we live in a spirit-haunted world, and I really love that term.
I've read parts of his book, Living Spirits, and it's something that is really high on my list to do. And I just, to be honest, I just haven't gotten there yet. I feel a little embarrassed to say that because I respect him.
There's another book that I am going to recommend to you. I won't say the name of it, but it's a really good book, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay, yeah, definitely. You can send me that privately, or if you want to tell me on the show here. But we could talk about spirits and types, and that's very much in my wheelhouse of interest. So back to the idea of summoning this random undecided elemental or spirit. That's something we'll say right now that the idea is set. Maybe the next time I'm on the show or when you're on the show, we can see how that idea has progressed. Because that I think would be interesting. And
yeah,
that's something you can be a part with, and then we can tell everybody.
I would very much to, I've been trying to get into a circle for a long time. So I think that would be really cool.
But I know one of the goals of doing that for me was part of it was on a magical level and part of it was to kind of examine, like if we could summon whatever entity we choose to summon. As a periphery goal to that, for me, is I wanted to specifically take note and examine in the best way I could the physical changes in the environment when that spirit manifested in whatever way it manifested, in terms of heat, in terms of, and I don't have a lot of scientific equipment, but even something like, did it get warmer? Did it get colder? Is there a smell of ozone? Keep, you know, any of those little environmental changes, and then document them and see if there's any correlation between that data and reports of people encountering cryptids or euphonauts or other occult. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so whatever
no,
we gain from that, you know, just on a magical level, is see if there's any data correlation between these phenomena that are not considered traditional occult phenomena and what we're doing, which is traditionally occult, to see if there's a correlation between these spirits.
I told you what this little very half-baked theory of mine
tell me
was earlier about the idea that some of the entities that people experience as far as cryptids go, seem to have parallels with manifestations that certain deities will use to contact possible devotees or targets of what they want, you know, someone that they want to be in contact with. And so in there you have this, you know, cryptids, which are not generally considered to be a part of the occult, being a possible avenue for an occult current to manifest into reality.
Right. And I mean, I think it's, I'm on your wavelength with that. And I think it's, we use the term cryptid, you know, in a modern paranormal sense as kind of a convenient term. But when you kind of remove the term, what you're dealing with a lot of different weird entities.
If I didn't think I was going to get chewed out by everyone in the paranormal community, I would call them preferably like dynamic
diamonds?
Spirits.
Oh.
Because yeah. They're like, you know, they're in this weird class, because we know that chthonic spirits and spirits of the Goetia, it takes a hell of a lot of effort for them to manifest into like a fully formed physical being.
They need energy.
And it takes away from your request. You know, if you have a pretty lengthy and involved charge, but you won't give it to them unless they've come to you in full physical form, if you do bind them correctly and you get what they, and you get them to do what you say, them coming to you in physical form is going to take away from their ability to manifest whatever it is that you asked for.
I'd say maybe.
I go by Skinner.
That's fair. Skinner's more knowledgeable than me. My only commentary would, I think it would depend on the spirit, how powerful that spirit is. But I mean, everything uses energy. I think greater spirits, angels, things like that, they have a lot more of it. So, but it still does require it. And it could be a situation where they just don't feel like it. But smaller spirits, like I would consider, you know, we're talking about probably smaller spirits on a scale compared to like an archangel. You know what I mean? So like we're talking about like a unique, you know, little underworld spirit or a, you know, whatever. Like they do have, you know, a specific amount of energy, just like we. And you're right. If you're asking them to directly do something, I'm sure there is a ratio of energy. If they have to do that, then they have to do that. It might be, they might not have enough energy to complete it just on ability, or it might just irritate them and they get tired and they say, you're not worth it. But, or be, you know, if you bound them and compulse them, then they might just be like, eh, you know, be like a dog that doesn't really want to move after a certain point because it's tired and grumpy at you. And then you'll get a less satisfactory work. But we don't know totally. We're talking about elementals or, you know, divine emissaries, we don't really know their power ratio or their scale to other things. That's part of the work I do. Or one of the things is try to actually figure out the differences in scale and potency and ability between you know, the infinitude of spirits that we know of in culture and in magical practice, but neither here nor there.
Well, Ian, we're out of time, but I just want to say how happy I was that you were able to come on the show, and I'm really excited to have you back on the show. I think we'll be hearing from you again pretty soon.
Oh, I'd love to, and I'm really thankful you had me on. I know we talk a lot in private, and to have this, you know, having me on this podcast, which I've come to enjoy personally, it means a lot, and it's amazing to talk to you, and I hope I have the opportunity to come on again.
Oh, you definitely will, and I really appreciate the kind words. It means a lot.
Well, of course. Well, have a good night.
You too. And that was my interview with Ian Burton. I am sure Ian will be on the show very, very soon. And with that, have a great night.